Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Welcome to Stick Together, Australia's only national radio show all about workers' rights and social justice. Stick Together is produced at 3CR Radio in Melbourne and broadcast to you around the country on the Community Radio Network. I'm Diana Beaumont. Our first story today is about a nationwide work stoppage on the 24th of March at CSIRO, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation. Louise Jarman, organiser with the CSIRO Staff Association in Victoria, talked to us about how CSIRO workers want a fair pay rise and a greater say in decision making. Then we'll turn to another issue relating to scientific and industrial development. We hear from Simon Miller, ETU member and electrician at the desalination project in Wonthaggi, Victoria. He talks about the environmental impact of the plant, the high cost, and industrial problems, including health and safety, and managers employing spies to monitor industrial activity.
He was employed on site to monitor people on site and off site, to go through and try and point out and identify to the company who were caused problems in terms of production and stuff on site to cease.
More from Simon later in the show, so stick with us for the next half an hour. On the 24th of March, scientists, researchers and admin staff stopped work for several hours at the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation, better known as CSIRO. It was the first strike ever at CSIRO in its 80-year history. The CSIRO Staff Association, which is associated with the Community and Public Sector Union, has been negotiating since last July over pay and staff's right to be involved in decision-making. But staff are not happy with the 3% pay rise that CSIRO is offering over the next 3 years, and they want management to consult with them in good faith when making decisions. To find out more about the work stoppages, I spoke to Louise Jarman, organiser with the CSIRO Staff Association in Victoria. Louise, start by telling us, why did CSIRO staff have the work stoppage on the 24th of March?
The work stoppage came about after a series of months of trying to get negotiations somewhere closer to where the scientists and the staff at CSIRO, so that support staff, would be happy with the agreement that they've got. So currently there is negotiations taking place, but where CSIRO senior management sits, so I'm talking, you know, people like the CEO, it's a far stretch from where the staff themselves want to sit. So we've had to work to try and get people to listen that sit in powerful positions and listen to people that, you know, lead our science in Australia. Because it's an ongoing theme within the workplace. It's not just about their agreement, their current agreement. It's an ongoing theme that's been there for a number of years, particularly around consultation.
Yeah, so tell us, this dispute isn't just about pay and benefits. Staff, researchers and admin at CSIRO are demanding more say in decision-making and a greater workplace democracy, I suppose you could put it. Can you tell us more about those demands?
Yeah. It's definitely, whilst pay is definitely, you know, part of the bargaining process, it's usually to maintain some level of income that is relative to, you know, what's going on in economy in general. So, you know, CPI, cost of living, that sort of thing. So that's not their main focus. Their main focus comes from a series of years where they, as scientists, have done projects and they're not getting the say that they should be getting. And we're not talking micromanaging here. You know, I can certainly hear lots of managers out there going, oh yes, of course, everyone wants to say. But this isn't about micromanaging. This is about when significant decisions are made in the workplace that are going to impact on individuals, groups of people, and in some cases sites. And there's no information gathering prior to the event, or if there is, it's a very minimal process. And sometimes it comes in the form of an email, which is more of a directive as opposed to, you know, let's go down a consultation process. So we're talking here exceptionally intelligent people. I mean, for goodness sake, this group of people, we wouldn't be anywhere without without them, because we all have Wi-Fi, well, most of us do. So they want to be heard. They want to be part of the organisation. They want to be the leaders that they're supposed to be, and you know, be able to mentor others. But you know, for them, it is about, you know, just hold us in some respect within the organisation, and you know, let us contribute. Because here's the thing, CSIRO senior management, we have something to contribute.
Yeah, the current CEO of CSIRO is Megan Clark, the former vice president of the mining company BHP Billiton. Can you tell us, are members satisfied with her approach at CSIRO?
Look, I honestly, I can't talk about, you know, the entire membership. All I can talk about is the feedback that I'm getting, particularly from the people who did take part in the strikes. But our feedback is that people are not happy with the leadership that's been demonstrated thus far. They did see Megan. I remember when she first came in, people were excited. People were looking forward to the possibility of having someone who was in a leadership role that was going to take into consideration things like consultation, but also to take on some of the history of the organisation that they felt needed change. So they definitely seen that this person had the potential to deliver a lot, and they were more than willing to go along for the journey. But unfortunately, the feedback that we're receiving from our members and from passionate people who participate in the strikes is that they're not happy with the way that Megan has handled herself since she's come into the organisation.
And can you give us an example of an issue where there wasn't consultation with staff at CSIRO?
There's been, I'll talk in very general terms. I won't try and be too specific because obviously some of those issues are still being worked through at the moment. But I guess when we do things like restructures, which is something that the CSIRO seems to go through a lot, and that's the amalgamation of groups of science that are then brought together. And it's more of a, this is a directive, we are going to go through an amalgamation, and this is what it's going to look like at the end, and here's your email to say that this is what's going to happen. If there is any consultation at all, it comes in the form of please provide your feedback, but people aren't feeling that that feedback is even listened to because the message or the objective doesn't change, and there doesn't seem to be any true consultation through those processes.
Right. Well, the staff association at CSIRO has pointed out that retaining expert researchers and support teams is crucial if the Australian government's going to get the best advice on issues like climate change and energy and water. Can you elaborate on that and say the national significance of workplace issues at CSIRO?
Sure. I guess in terms of if we look at CSIRO, CSIRO has things like it has a compass, and the compass is about, you know, all things that are good. And the things that it talks about is, you know, we need to have the mantra of we need to attract the best scientists in the world, and we need to, you know, be this organisation that people want to come to. Now, what we're seeing is, yes, that's a very good mantra, and a lot of these things that are written in documentation nationally definitely support where everyone would like CSIRO to go, and including the importance for government to focus on attracting those people. But yet what we're seeing behind the scenes is a little bit in the opposite direction, because if you don't look at consulting with people that are leading scientists or leading in their areas, so it's not just about scientists, you know, there are support people out there, there are people that are in publishing, there are people who are in education that are trying to get our future students, you know, from very young ages that go out to primary schools to encourage people to go into science. So it's also our future. So nationally, our government needs to be embracing that. So nationally, I feel that in terms of the organisation, they're saying one thing in what they give out as the organisation stamp, but they're doing the complete opposite.
Right. In terms of this industrial dispute and the issues that have been on the table, we've also heard that staff at CSIRO in Melbourne in particular spoke about internship programs through which international students or junior scientists are paid at a far lower rate than other staff. Can you tell us more about this?
I can't go into detail about that purely because I don't know the specifics of what the person may have been talking about. So I've not got enough information to go into that with you today.
Right. And back to this question of the work stoppage that took place at CSIRO on the 24th of March. How long has it been since there was industrial action at CSIRO? Is this a first?
In terms of this particular nature, so we're talking taking a strike, which is very significant. It's never happened before. They have taken action, but they've done it on their own time. So they've done it in a more passive approach. I believe they've done things like a work-in, so where everyone went to work and did excessive hours. they've had like black T-shirt days where they've you know demonstrated in colour. I even believe that they came into the city of Melbourne in their white coats. But my understanding is that they've never actually taken a strike.
And my final question, what was CSIRO's response to the strike and what's the plan if they don't make a better offer?
At this stage, they're actually in negotiations this morning. So we can take from that that, you know, hopefully that is them standing up and having a listen to what the strike was talking about and the people that went to that strike. So I won't know what the next steps will be until the outcome of that is perceived, is reached today. Once that has happened, I would imagine that in the next week or so, we'll be going out and talking to our members about what it is that they want to do for the next steps. Because if there's one thing that the Staff Association, I guess, is very, very careful to do, is this is about the members. This isn't about a union or a representative group, you know, coming up with, you know, this is the way we should guide you. This is about the true members of CSIRO standing up and wanting to have a say. So we'll be guided, by the outcome of today, and then we'll be guided by the members next week as to where we foresee the next steps to be taken.
Excellent. Well, we hope you see a positive outcome.
We certainly do.
Yeah, we've been speaking to Louise Jarman, who's an organiser with the Community and Public Service, the Public Sector Union in Victoria, and with the CSIRO Staff Association, telling us about a series of work stoppages that occurred on the 24th of March around the country at CSIRO to demand more staff participation in decisions and also a reasonable pay increase. Louise, thanks for the update.
Thanks, Diana.
And there is an online blog where you can find out more about the dispute at csirobargaining2011.org.
Stick together.
You're listening to Stick Together on Community Radio.
The desalination plant at Wonthaggi in Victoria is currently under construction. It made news on the 1st of March when the new coalition government in Victoria announced that the cost of the project had been severely underestimated by the previous Labor government. The plant was originally estimated to cost $5.7 billion, but the new Victorian government has now increased their estimate to $24 billion from now until 2040. And this will certainly cause an increase in the price of water for consumers. The desalination plant also made news late last year when the main contractor, Thiess, was caught hiring spies to gather information about union activity on site. Two managers were fired over the incident at the demand of union members. To find out more about these controversies surrounding industrial relations, economics and environmental impacts at the Wonthaggi desalination plant, I spoke to Simon Miller, an electrician who works on the site and is a member of the Electrical Trades Union. So Simon, remind us, this is no small project. How big is the desal construction project up in Wonthaggi and how many people are employed on it?
Well, it's huge. It's easily the biggest construction site I've been on. Like there's around roughly 40 operating cranes. It's like a small city, even in terms of the huts. When I first arrived there, I used to have to take a bus to get to the particular huts we were going to on the day, and that took a good 5 minutes to get over to the huts that we were actually working from.
Yeah.
So the place is massive. It's the biggest, obviously, people would know it's the biggest desal plant in the world.
And how many workers on site?
Well, it's roughly around 1,600 at the present time.
So the whole desalination plant has been controversial because the technology is highly polluting and the water produced by the desal plant is going to be very expensive. Can you quickly tell us more about these issues?
Well, it's an economic abomination. I can't, like, talk. I know that they've, this is some of the ways that the actual local campaign has impacted on the site in terms of the beast was forced to sort of bring in and whole lots of what are called, you know, green technology to try and ameliorate some of these concerns. So I'm not, I'm not an expert on terms of the, what the environmental impact's going to be when they, in particular, pump, they're going to be pumping tons of brine out into the ocean. But for instance, they've changed, and in response to the, you know, the environmental concerns, you know, these were forced to design a intake system where the water, rather than being sucked into the plant, is actually using the natural tidal flow to bring water into the pipes. And that means that apparently that, you know, if any fish or, you know, marine life get caught in the tidal intake, they come into this what's called, you know, this basin area, and then they get taken out again when the tide goes out. So obviously, you know, it's not going to be perfect, but I think that that campaign can really pat itself on the back that this actually forces the Southeast and the government to actually try and do what they can to ameliorate the worst environmental effects.
But critics,
you know, the major environmental effect is that they've taken a, you know, particularly beautiful part of the coastline and they've built this huge site on it, and so that's the most obvious one. The other most obvious one is the fact that this plant, whether it's environmental or not, is going to be sucking an enormous amount of energy.
Yeah, and critics point out that it's certainly not the cheapest or most effective way to be delivering water to Melbourne. The cost has now blown out, according to The Age, to $24 billion by 2040.
Yes, the economics of it are just, you know, at the moment, water is pricing at around $1.50 a megalitre. The estimates from the Hansard were that, you know, after the end of this project, that this would raise the cost of water to over $13 a megalitre. Now, obviously, they're not going to be able to get away with increasing our water bills by 13 times because the market won't bear it. It is going to mean that there's going to be, obviously at least a doubling or tripling of our water bills. And so this is really expensive. In terms of the cost, I mean, the cost is astounding. And this is the reason why I like working on the site, that this has nothing to worry about going over time on this project, because they've done this 30-year deal with the government where they run the plant for 30 years, and they're basically going to get, you know, billions of dollars. It's around Hansard. I think it's Hansard talks about $274 billion they get paid. $274 million they get paid without even having to produce a drop of water.
Right. Certainly no rush to get the plant up and running. But let's talk more about the companies who are operating the plant. Who are they?
Well, the major company that's operating it is Thiess d'Egremont. Thiess is the construction site, and d'Egremont are a French desalination company. So Thiess are the principal contractors. They're actually running the electrical side of it, there is a lot of subcontractors, but they're mainly being employed in the construction side of it, in the civil side, in the rigging and the concreting, and so there's a plethora of small contractors who are coming in there and doing short jobs, you know, for a couple of months and then leaving.
Well, in Melbourne, the desal plant in Wonthaggi has a reputation for being a strongly unionised site, and particularly with fairly high pay of somewhere between $2,000 or $3,000 a week. Is that true? Is that reputation deserved? Is it a strong union site down there, for example?
It's a mixed bag, to be honest. Everybody is in the union, but that's in union name only. Obviously, they can't enforce a closed shop or be seen to be enforcing a closed shop because of the laws. But in practice, as far as I can tell, except for, you know, some of the CMFEU sectors where people have said that it looks like there's, you know, small contractors are coming in out of there who haven't got, you know, their members aren't in union. The vast bulk of even the CMFEU site are all in the union. But there's a difference between, you know, often those, that's union in name only. Often what's happened is that the company, and these are non-union companies who basically buy their members' union tickets and bring their members on site in order to, you know, so that there's industrial peace. But their members actually have no union culture. And in the senior view in particular, I mean, that's where the biggest problems are on site in terms of health and safety. It's the most dangerous part of the site, and it's also where there's been the most accidents and the most near misses, and also where they have whole lots of basically company stewards plagued through the right through the CMFU. The EGU and the metals are pretty good. The EGU in particular, I'd say, you know, not wanting to be biased, but we have a very an excellent shop steward and health and safety reps, and they place the site very well. I'd say the next best on site would be the metals, who have got some very good reps and stuff on site as well. But I've heard some grumblings even there. But the plumbers always run their own race and they get completely opportunist. But the same view, I guess, is the place where there's the most problem. In terms of pay rates, yes, look, this is a site where they've consciously gone out to bribe workers so that there's industrial peace. So the wages are very, workers are taking home between $2,000 and $3,000 a week. That is true.
Yeah. Well, even though pay's high on the site, there have been industrial disputes down there. Can you tell us about some of them? In particular, the main contractor on the site employing a security firm to monitor workers on site?
Yeah, so that was a very interesting dispute. That actually happened before I came on site, but that was Bruce Townsend with his old security firm, and Bruce is well known as a strike breaker who was employed in the MUA dispute and has been employed even before that, and had actually just recently got out of jail for using his base in Tasmania to sell stolen cars.
What did Thies try and do?
Well, it looks like he was employed to basically... He was employed on site to monitor, to be part of both monitoring people on site and off site, to go through and try and point out and identify to the company who were caused problems in terms of production and stuff on site to see. So they were the ones who were going around doing background checks. So they were meant to be having people planted in sheds and stuff to overhear conversations and basically telegraph to Thies, be at president union meetings to try and tell. And, you know, any hints or signs that there may be industrial action.
And after that was discovered, what action were taken against the Thies managers who organised this?
Well, yeah, the workers voted to go out. This was on the Thursday, and they went out Thursday. They came back Friday and went out and decided to come back Monday. Basically, there was actually a rank and file revolt. It was assumed that on Monday the unions were going to order everybody back to work under an agreed settlement. And then they turned up Monday. It was even recorded in the Age that the dispute had been resolved in the Sunday Age. And then the union officials turned up, and there was a mini revolt led by a section of riggers who every other day that our workers had been disciplined or threatened with the sack. And here we have two managers who, while having been removed from site, have not been continued to be employed. So they upped the ante and demanded that those managers be sacked. And they also up the ante in terms of there's actually a separate disputes board on site. And that disputes board has been a way that the union's been able to sort of, stop industrial action and let take the steam off issues by referring. There's been an actual backlog in that disputes board of all these disputes, which had actually been ruled by the disputes board in the union's favour, which Thies just completely failed to act upon. Mm. So they also added that. They said, if Thies is saying in this agreement that they're now going to abide by the disputes board, we have all these past disputes that we want them to be resolved as well, as a sign of good faith. So they got a double, and they also put up the motion that they stay out until there was a response to that from Thies, and they report back the next day. So the dispute went on an extra day, which, you know, that's obviously, you know, every day on that site costs $1 billion in terms of cranes and whatever else on hire. And they came back the next day, and Thies had quickly capitulated to both those demands. And the dispute was basically resolved on the basis that, yes, they would have they would resolve all those past issues. The two managers were sacked, who are now actually suing for fees.
We've been through some health and safety issues that exist on the desal plant, and also this case of Thiess hiring security firms to monitor potential activists on site. Just my last question, what in sum do you think needs to be improved on the desal plant?
Okay.
In terms of industrial relations and workplace rights?
It's an interesting site. The reality, there's tons of health and safety issues that need to be improved on site, especially in civil, which I don't really feel qualified to act upon. But I know that there's lots of dust issues and especially workers working on top of each other. There was an attempt by Thiess recently to try and sack one of the best senior for you health and safety officers. And that led to a one-day dispute, and that guy's disciplinary action was withdrawn. And so Thiess are still, even despite the spy stuff, whatever, are still, you know, aggressively trying to make sure that the unions stay in line. This site is taking an extraordinarily long time to build because of the nature of what's been done by Thiess. Because they actually bid for this and they bid to have it done in a particular time so that they got the contract, it means that this site's been built without any sort of proper programming. And so there's been often been a comment and stuff on site that we couldn't slow this job down even if we wanted to. And it's nothing to do with the workers on site. It's to do with the fact of Thiess having taken this stuff and actually having to draw up plans and stuff on the go. And so there's constantly been building errors and mistakes. And early on, and because they brought in whole lots of basically non-union labour from Perth, who they've had to basically replace. They had whole lots of things built wrongly, and there's just been, you know, combined with the weather has meant that this job is going to stretch out. I don't see it being built for another 2 years.
Right, a massive expense to the taxpayers.
Deal done with the ALP, they're still going to make a fortune at the end.
Right. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. Thanks so much, Simon, for the update on the site, and thanks for joining us on the show.
Okay, no worries.
And Simon asked me to clarify following the program that the wage rate of $2,000 to $3,000 a week that he mentioned in the interview comes only after doing a 56-hour week without proper overtime pay and including a living away from home allowance. But that's all we've got time for today on Stick Together. The show was recorded at 3CR in Melbourne and broadcast to you around Australia via the Community Radio Network. We'd like to thank the Community Broadcasting Foundation for its financial support. If you'd like any more information about today's program, please contact us at stick.together@hotmail.com or call 3CR Radio on 03 9419 8377. You can download a copy of the program from 3CR's website, 3cr.org.au. I'm Diana Beaumont. Thanks for listening, and tune in again at the same time next week.